it's amazing how being number two swiftly becomes number one again. So okay, so this is a new poem, it's not a band poem or a rock and roll poem. I was talking to Shane outside, you were talking to Silence, and this one is actually derived from my fear of silence in certain types of environments. And it begins with a quote from Mark Twain. "No word was ever effective as a rightly timed pause," Mark Twain. It's hard, I'm sure, you will agree to doubt the wisdom of Mr. Twain. There is just too much evidence to deny the veracity of his statement. Picture, if you please, an actor postponing a critical line. Hear the audience hush, see their widened eyes, feel emotion swell in their hearts. Now imagine a comic eyeing devotees through a self-created silence that she and everyone present knows will be punctured by a punchline designed and delivered to generate hilarity. Can you feel their anticipation? Can you taste their bated breath? Can you hear the electricity they share? Finally, I give you a footballer, deliberately shuddering his form or stuttering his feet just before he strikes a vital penalty kick. Do you not want to freeze that moment, bottle it, carry it with you for eternity that suspense-saturated second? Allow yourself time to decide, should I open my eyes or await the raucous roar of approval? Disparate, despairing drone. But there is, of course, an opposite. The times when we have been force-fed the most toxic of dishes. Yes, I present to you the ill-timed pause. That disastrous devil that manifests at moments we wish had never occurred. A stony silence, a horrid hush, a grossly Gantorian gap that gobbles good, leaving us bereft, hollow, as fallow as forgotten fields. Such pain, my friends, such pain, and we never forget. In each of us lurks the wound of a child who with expectant eyes sought parental approval, but was met by the sulky stare of dismissal. In each of us the agony of a teacher's narcissistic glower sits festering like a cesspit. In each of us lies the hurt of a lover's silent response to a request for affection. And the past, I tell you now, is always trying to break into the present. Take now, for example. I stand before you hoping, nay praying, this missive will not be met by the opposite of Mark Twain's subtle observation, that my past will not be offered entry to the present, but will be foiled by the sonic sweetness created when an additional Papa and a Lima mix with the double Alpha, Papa, Uniform, Sierra and Echo that create a pause. So, my friends, let me outline my desire. I want, when I end, for you to fire your hands percussive gifts, to fill this space and my heart with felicitous flurry of fingers on palms, to avoid, at all costs, my final word being met by an ill-timed pause, the perilous rock on which plenty a poem has perished. Do you understand? I hope so, for the moment is upon us. I can delay no longer. My end is here, and you must decide, am I to be met with? Or can you muster a poet's, and indeed a poem's, most pleasurable epilogue, a rousing round of applause?
Beautiful, great signals behind your backs, telling you, oh my God. just to be mischievous. Next, we have Dawn Harding.
We all dream about the muse coming to us some night and having a cup of tea and saying this is for you. You wake up in the morning and there it is. You have a cup of tea and just pick it up and read it. Night words. I dreamt of words that fell into my head. Boxes all wrapped up, gifted from the dead. Those words rose me, stabbed me awake. I knew I was alive. The bed began to shake. Cracks came in the boards. The words slipped in. Got lost among the cobwebs, dark and dreary din. A spider darted out, its words upon his back. I offered him a fly. He dropped through a crack. Now I tried to separate the dream from the lie. A splinter in my thumbnail, a silken web to ply. A spider knits his web, dreaming another spider's dreams. From the hub of his universe comes ripples in leaves. Thanks.
Thank you, Dawn. And next we have our final word challenge winner, Shane.
So a friend of mine is going through a bit of a writing drought at the minute, so we have a game. I wrote her a poem and she wrote me a poem, and we gave each other the first line. So this starts with the line that she gave me. It's a little bit rough because I've been working on it all this week, so we'll see how it goes. It ended with a swollen kiss, before the parting of one soul in two, before a frantic of fingers crawled up skin, like maybe we could grab at pain, like maybe we could take it back with your name in my tongue and your tongue in my name, before we said, I'm sorry, not for what we were, but what we weren't, like maybe we could, like maybe we could by swallowing whole.
Good. Charles Clark. For anyone here from Cantor, I take the answer as no. I was reading Jerry Murphy's most recent book last night when I suddenly felt a poem coming out. So this is a draft. And I'm reading it exactly as it is, more or less. Myself, no title. Myself, my brother, and our friend, Dan Daly of Kanturk, lifted to Cork in his father's lorry on one of the days of deep mourning for the bishop, not well loved, Dr. Colan. Walked around Cork, lunched in the Pav, the pavilion, only place open, and then walked and walked to the marina. Very exhausted, we sat down in the street. I do not remember that we wept, nor remember Zion, while we waited for the evening train.
Patricia Walsh, thank you, John.
Hi, Susan. I wrote this book last night. It hasn't got a title, but it's kind of a love poem. Let's pretend we are in love, snatching moments from mutual love books. Mutual recycled kisses from eager animals, embraces between floors incessantly. Let's depress ourselves with distance. Length's irrelevant, the clock is cruel anyway. Keeping court, we're recording kisses incessantly, burning records to save our secret. More green corners, plotting further choice. Swearing pledges over coffee is par for the course. Eating mutual hearts, decking some jewellery, terminology is just another hurdle. Eyes of desire, exchange their glances. Some of us laugh, harping our vacant stunts. In between set existence and self-derision, deserving punishment, not as a creature. Sleeping at double danger, breathing your scent, softly moves in rhythm of warmth. Rhythmic breath in time to death, night is not long enough to save your silk. A prayer won't keep you, bear in mind, my pretensions won't change while you're around. I shut down my senses, singing lively, at the proposal of a self-same return. Thank you.
Thank you, Patricia. And next we have Cedric.
This one is a Dale. Those stairs, they saw everything. The good, the bad, and the unsupervised. They were the playground to the grounded, and just a flight to those in hurry. Those stairs, when new, were an alibi to cover illegal activities. Then, witness of exchanges, movings, slide down and run by. They were the creaking path that sung the time to bed. Those stairs were hastening the growth of a family, the rise and the descent into adulthood. Those steps wept in support to those who cried in despair. They tattletale of teenager late night activity that has been ignored countless times, letting him learn and watch on TV how his peers communicate and pair. They were the pedestal to the proud laureate, walk to the rest for the defeated. They stayed behind man-made witness of life for the father and mother, daughters and sons. Those stairs became much more than the cheap wood they were made from.
Thanks, Cedric. And next we have Philip Splann.
I'm just going to go right through it because it's kind of long, but I'll cut out a bit if it comes to it. The nymphs, they want Wi-Fi. They want to stuff their copper cables through their trees and wind it through their water homes and be connected to the metallic plastic machines to be easily welcomed into the new realm of communication. All to their mother Gaia's dismay, who doesn't quite get it, how her pan is managing, and found a new pleasure in being a trickster troll and picking vulnerable neighbors remotely. You see him hunched on a tree, young goat legs bringing the white display in suspended kiss distance. And his panpipes have sadly fallen from that height and now grow dusty. It has affected the poets immensely. The muses no more tickle their intellect. And they hesitate in front of their leaf pages blank, feeling the punch of soulless depression and everlasting writer's block. They plea on virtual notice boards for any spark of nymph, however, now are drowning in new silence of disattention, like they're sinking in the HTML color of blue. I was clicking on the 61 keys skillfully when I heard it, the day when Mythos died. I heard it lodged in between a self-portrait of green-eyed Aphrodite, an echo screaming in desperation, trying to understand areas in life that I've already reached. However, this struck me. Mythos has died? The long-bearded dreadlock mad dog, who wore tick clothing, and sprouted tails in late nights after a heavy dose of whiskey? I hushed away human tears and replaced them with reason. Should we contact Logos, his brother? So I phoned him. He was programming Java at the time, and I could hear him slurping fast food Chinese back. And he knew already. Harris sounded dull and uncaring, and slowly clicked himself back into 500 lines of code. Was he hiding feelings? Was he reflecting his namesake? But Mythos has died. That should have provoked sorrow. At this time, I seeked anyone that cared besides myself. I felt like I wanted to crack my teeth over my tongue. It was as if all humanity had died with my friend. And all care was bled from veins in a place where copper wires pumped full of electrical impulses of heavy inflow protocols. The funeral was a perfect sunny day. All were here, however, eyes locked on miniature flat phones. I was too, but that was beside the point. They all should have paid attention. They all seemed more entertained by Artemis coming out that she was lesbian. I tried to strike a conversation with Athena. However, she was getting red-hot angry after someone had abused her blog with fire insults on her snarky, biased wisdom ways. In whole, I tried to understand the mythical mess before me. However, to all the disattention, as the coffin missile sunk into the ground, I saw Logos standing in front of it all, and a sudden flash of a single tear curled down his face to his lip and tripped onto his brother's coffin, and his face turned stone again and left. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. And now I think we have somebody new on the open mic, Cornelius.
Yeah, it's I'm a comedian, so I've been trying some poems recently, and so I hope you hate this. It's called the. It's actually one out of a trilogy of poems I'm writing about Batman. There he is. It's called The Joker, and why I'm kind of like it. I'm an agent of chaos, just like the Joker. Like a dog chasing a car, I too would not know what to do if I caught it. Patrick's my middle name, but I'm looking into changing it to Chaos. Here are some of the crazy things I do. Sometimes when I play pitch and putt, I don't pay green fees. Sometimes after ordering and paying for food in my local chipper, I tell them I pay for a Coke too and get a free tin of Coke. Sometimes when I'm stopped at a guard at checkpoint, I act all confident and tell them that I just bought the car and I'm awaiting my tax in the post. I'm not. You see, there really is no difference between me and the Joker from the Batman series. I'm an agent of mayhem, just like him. Cornelius Patrick O'Sullivan. Soon to be Cornelius Chaos O'Sullivan. Thank you. Yay!
Thank you, Cornelius. Come back and create some more chaos for us. You're more than welcome. Next, we have Anthony.
Hey, I'm actually not a poet either. He's a poet. I'm not a poet. I'm just a comedian that he convinced to come down here. But I wrote this. I'm also writing my memoir. It's called Harry Potter and the Bucket of Fried Chicken. Where are you, little buddy? I search in quiet reflection. The mood was right on this fateful night, and our friend had no objection. You cut out way too early, just like a bad C-section. She says it's fine. I tell her it's the first time. Those words are just pure fiction. This has happened once too often. We were wandering predilection. So as I cry alone, I write this poem, an ode to my lost direction.
Good one. All right, and next we have Max Creedon. Do you need to set up, Max?
Okay.
We're getting a bit of music here.
She get music?
Yeah.
I often wonder why do I put myself to this each one.
Oh, we know why you put this out.
I'm always nervous before.
We get entertained.
I might try it here soon.
Would you? Okay, right. I can hold this for you.
Be good.
Can I do that?
Okay. Mm-hmm. I wonder if I get five. I just want to do, I know there's a 3-minute curfew, so I've got to do 1 minute song, 1 minute poem, if that's okay. And I want to try and get this one out, because me and my art, I always, my ecclesia, as Paul would teach me, and that's poor old Samuel Beckett, I just love his face. And this makes perfect sense to me, but it mightn't make sense to you. This is my thoughts when I'm sketching him, because I just love sketching his face. But it's called A Journey of the Face, for Samuel Beckett. So I hope it makes sense to you. His aquiline cliff face takes a bearing from the sea, surveys the time and tides, for his words to ebb and leap. Like a mastiff of a Roman legion, is carved from limestone rock, a forehead set in sections,
burned sculpted karst and blocks, racked in neat and racks, and ravaged with such beauty. The peaty slice of dermis forms a thatched old crop of socket, secretes secret onks of liquid sheen. In furrow burrows the top lip in a crossbow to a cutting mouth. It hides a cavern to withhold a word torrent before the spit of water trickle fall over walnut chin of rock. How stern this bow to view below the anchored sails of Dicemen and Harlequin, remember his nickname now, the anchored sails of Dicemen and Harlequin, his rigid mottled mast, the cacophony of skin, the veils of many years wrap the venom prized within. So that's his face to me.
I'm off the stage now in 2 minutes.
Can I upload that? Yeah, if you can. Yeah, so I'd really appreciate it. As I say, I should see if it's tuned up there now. Okay. This is about my other life. I saw a lot of empathies. And this is another type of phantom pain that it's been in my head always, but a granddad passed away. And I had to bring this 84-year-old woman back into her little room, and they were together 65 years, and she just froze when she saw the chair. And this isn't a new theme, it happens to everybody. But I felt the pain course into her body, and she's the kind of woman who couldn't emote. But I felt I went away and I wrote this song for what she'd say in the car. So, next sense to me, as I always say. Glasses up. Where are we back to this thing here? Okay. Statue. Okay. An empty heart, a vacant chair.
Lost for a long time. It's kind of like getting a delivery from a postal service that can time travel. And so I'm going to sing this song. It's pretty old. Let me say it first. The more that you say that you don't give a fuck, the more that you show you care. And the places and scenes from the stories that you tell, well, I just can't picture you there. For if you hadn't told the truth when I wanted you to, how else would I have known that you lied? And now looking back at the moments we shared, would I really have known? Would you really have cared if I died? The last I saw you was the last time I cried, and was the last time that I wore a tie. The last you saw me, you told me your hands were tied, and was the last time that I saw you cry. Now I don't often sigh, but I don't laugh much, and I wonder why we didn't keep touch. It's not that I'm lonely, I need to fill a void, it's more that I love you as such. When I was 17 and my teeth were clean, I had too much time to say what I thought. And then when I got older, the things I hadn't told you became less of what it is, more what it's meant. And when I saw you again, we had nothing to say. Forgot the common thoughts that we had. You paint your pictures, babe, and I'll write the words. Just not together, and ain't that sad? Now I heard you found someone to hold you, but I could have told you that comfort is a funny thing. Cause as you're sitting in his arms and listening to his tones, it's my voice that you hear sing. Singing songs about the future and happier times, and the day that we'd hear the bells ring. Now it hasn't happened, I've been saying to myself, no matter how it hurts, no matter how it hurts, don't let it sting. You're weighing my thoughts and I'm in them too, and baby, we are still young. Sitting to myself without knowing what'll happen. Why will these songs ever be sung? When I think of you and your eyes with peace, only these songs will ever be sung. I'll still be here singing songs about the future. Because baby, you are my cure.
Did you like it?
Yeah.
I hope so. Do you know what I like about Monday nights? You stand on your tiptoes like that, and you look really good, you can see Friday.
Thank you, guys. Now, I thought that Rab was here, but apparently he isn't. So don't tell him that, but his far handsomer, far more intelligent, far more interesting alter ego is here, so let's hear from him. Bobby. Why Bobby?
Bobby. Obviously, Bobby. Let's,
hang on a minute.
This is a Bokkanen magazine, or poetry journal thing of new writing. It's published in summer 1993 in response to the trouble with Los Angeles, the Rodney King riots. Some of you may have not been born in 1983. We'll read you a small bit about this. Like, tiny little poem here from Linda Smith Hunter. riot, according to Webster. 1. Wild or violent disorder, confusion. 2. Disturbance of peace by the number of persons in law, 3 or more, assembled together. How could win Brezno the beating of Rodney King? So here's a bit of a monologue. It kind of plays on the Rodney King Kong, and so it's called Kong, yeah? By a guy called Harold Jaff. And I was asking Daw down there if he'd ever heard of Harold Jaff, because Daw has been Daw saw Jimi Hendrix in 1964 over in Bedford. So Daw's hip, man. I don't know Harold Jaff at all. So anyway, Harold Jaff, calm. Did you hear? Excessive force by the LAPD. They subdued a black man, right? Ha! About 20 cops surrounded him, shot him with a stun gun, kicked him, clubbed him, fractured his eye socket, fractured his cheekbone, broke the bones in his skull in 11 places, damaged his facial nerves, broke his leg. What's the deal? They said he'd be speeding, doing 130 on the Santa Monica Freeway. 130? What kind of car was he driving? 79 Pinto. With a brand spanking new Porsche engine, right? Right. Was he armed? No. Didn't like his attitude when they ordered him out of the car. Another black attitude case, huh? What did he say he was doing? Jiving, high-fiving, breakdancing, I don't know. They said he was dusty, stoned on PCP. Was he? No. Test indicated no. So they shot him with their stun gun, kicked him with their heavy cop shoes, clubbed him with their batons on the head and face and torso and legs, especially on the head and face, up to 56 times. Why the head and face? He wasn't about to hurt them with his head and face. True, except he was black, unbroken. They didn't like the shape of his skull, didn't think he had a face and a mouth, teeth. They didn't like that he had a face and a mouth and teeth, that he could laugh. But he wasn't laughing, was he? I seriously doubt it. They just don't like black laughter. Now you're cooking. So they clubbed him 56 times. Pause. Didn't DiMaggio set a record by hitting in 56 straight games? 1943, wasn't it? It was 41, I think. Right, Nazis, Japs, our good war. How do we know, anyway, who, what, that the black driver of the 79 Pinto that goes 130 miles per hour was shot and kicked and clubbed up to 56 times? A guy, an amateur, shot the whole thing with a video cam from his window across the street. Cops didn't know they were being filmed, because if they did, they would have been less brutal, they would have been more brutal, they would have taken the video cam away from the guy and kicked his ass into the bargain. Pause. You want me to choose? I do. Okay, number 3. They would have taken the video cam away from the guy and kicked his ass into the bargain. Excellent. You've won a prize. What did I win? What? What did I win? You won a steak and lobster dinner for two at Sparks Steakhouse on Manhattan, celebrating East Side. Sparks? Sparks? Wasn't that where that Mafia capo was rubbed out last year? Oh, right. Oh, so. Gangland style. Blood all over the walls? Right. Italians bleed a lot. You've got a good memory. Uh-huh. Well, what now? For the cops or the victim? Good question. Did I say that after the beating, but before they found out about the video, the cops falsified their reports? What did they do? They claimed the alleged black perpetrator had resisted arrest and they used only minimal force. That's pretty routine, isn't it? Cops falsifying the reports. Depends on how you define routine. What about racial slurs? What about them? The arresting cops are white? Naturally. So you must have used racial slurs, no? You mean like clubbing him and calling him Coon and clubbing him and calling him Jig and clubbing him and calling him Nip? Enough! Okay, so they used racial slurs. What do you expect? I don't have any expectations. Pause. What about the black man? Did he have a record? Served 3 years, second degree robbery. What did he rob? Well, he tried to rob a convenience store, bungled. He pleaded guilty? Yeah, said he was out of work and desperate. You believe it? That he was out of work and desperate? Fuck yeah. What else? About him? He's 26 years old, lives in Compton, big soccer, 6'3", 225 pounds, works construction when he works, shacks with his common-in-law wife and her three kids, described as slow. By who? What? Described as slow by whom? Well, after the ship blew, I mean the videotape, the police released a letter that the alleged black perpetrator had written to a judge asking for a reduced sentence. That was while he was in prison on the robbery rap. Do you want to hear it? Yeah, I do. Dear judge, I have all good time, work time. I have seriously been thinking about what happened. I think it is possible that you can give me another chance, Your Honour. I have a good job and three fine kids wish me home. Have so much at stake to lose if I don't get that chance. My family and job awaits me, so please reconsider your judgment. Your Honour, the sky my witness and God knows. So what happened to his plea? It was summarily rejected. He did his time. He went back to his life such as it was. What about his family, his kids? Who knows? What the fuck? Who the fuck can answer for these people and their sordid, impossible lives? Pause. You know, one thing stands out for me in this whole thing. What's that? Technology. Video cameras are getting cheaper all the time. More and more ordinary folks are buying them. They're darn easy to use. What I'd like to see are cash bonuses offered to people who vidcam bad guys, drug dealers, muggers, gangbangers, terrorists, bad cops. Great thing is, you can shoot the stuff while you're hidden, like the guy who shot the rogue cops, plus it's admissible in court as evidence. Video cam vigilante mercenaries? It has an American ring to it, doesn't it?